thank you very much.
Yeah, I will try to get our points at least to a certain extent across. And I realize that the science goes from our own program. Most of you are pretty far away from those points of matter, at least in your scientific interest, and personally not, because you mostly consist of water and stuff. To do that, I first would like to introduce a little bit what soft matter is and why soft matter is soft, to explain you why it behaves as it behaves, at least in very rough ideas, and then go to some examples of how I can try, how we try to deal with that. And you will realize during the presentation that we do not have one or two major questions. The field is fairly broad, and try to tackle the problems by scale bridging simulations is not that old as well. And one of the purposes of this program here is to bring people together and maybe to figure out the more unified approaches. Let's see whether we're able to do that. Well, we have to always stick to the problem that we have for every problem, more or less, to design our own way of doing that. To start with, of course, you all know soft matter, and you have to deal with it. So what is soft matter? Well, soft matter is what we call soft matter, I should say. But it's anything like common plastics. Pop this around here, you have the styrofoam cups, you have the forks, all this plastic, but you have their plastic, common plastics. So commodities, as industry calls it, which means under 200 million tons per year, something like this. Cheap stuff. But also tissue. Of course, almost all food. From a physics perspective, there's not that much difference between this and this in many points. And if you want to understand that on a more physical basis, questions and problems are quite similar. However, it's not only this, it's of course also many, many materials for electronic applications. So if you think of something like organic electronics, a hot topic in many areas nowadays, or if you think of functional biology, biological materials, the systems of proteins, etc. And of course also structural materials. So that means that soft matter is everywhere, so to speak, and it's certainly very interesting and important to understand that better. And specific systems here out of this are of course proteins or simple plastics like polystyrene or DNA, which is a kind of very nice specific polymer macromolecule you would like to understand better, and also liquid crystals and many others. So the question now is, why is this soft matter soft? And the soft matter is soft essentially because the relevant energy scale, which we have to deal with, is given by the room temperature, by the thermal energy KT. And that, for 300 Kelvin, typically where we live at, is about 4.1 times 10^12. This is not much. If we compare this to typical other energies, so for instance, that's about 4.025 electron volts, or for people from quantum chemistry, it's about 10^-3 hydrogen. So this is certainly an energy which is much smaller than one can achieve by typical microscopic calculations, such as the macroscope. It's one of the problems which I will not dwell on further on, but it's one of the topics in our discussion points in our program, how to get to better interaction parameters, force fields already at the microscopic level, because we have to deal, or we are facing with an energy scale which is certainly still beyond what one can do with standard quantum chemistry or CKD-like approaches. So how does it now altogether produce soft material? So you can make a very simple estimate of elastic constants, which the very first approximation can be approximated by the energy density in the system. And the argument I'm showing is actually, I heard it first from Paul Chaykin. I do not know whether it's really due to Paul Chaykin, but at least the first one I heard it from. So if you think of a typical crystal, like this BCC crystal, and you think of nearest neighbor energy, it is 1 to 2 kT from noble gas crystal to crystallization point, and then up to about 100 kT for covalently bonded crystals at room temperature. When you end up with a critical energy density, I know these are kind of weird units, but that tells us a little bit what is going on, of about 5 to 100 kT per cubic angstrom. And if I take a typical polymeric melt, like a polycarbonate, which I have here in the glasses, for instance, optical grade polycarbonate, which looks like this, so the chains are kind of interpenetrating. Then you have a typical distance between these chains, which is of the order of 3 to 6 angstroms. They have typically around 5 to 6 neighboring chains in the environment of a given chain. And when I then take the typical van der Waals interaction, which is of the order of a few kT for strands approaching each other, when I end up with an energy density, which is roughly of the order of 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the minus 1 kT per cubic angstrom at room temperature. And those of you who worked a long time ago on colloidal crystals, I look at it specifically, you get another few decades in the energy density down the road. And now you can compare this to a typical elastic moduli which you have. Well, a standard crystal has an elastic modulus of the order of about 100 gigapascals. If you rewrite this in terms of energy per cubic angstrom, that is roughly 25 kT per angstrom cubed. So right in the middle of these numbers which you have there. And then you take a typical piece of plastic, rubber or something like this, you arrive at numbers somewhere between 10 or 10 to the 3 megapascal. And that one is approximately 0.0325. That simply shows that just from the simple argument, it's not surprising that these organic, typically organic materials are of the order of 1,000 times softer when it comes to response to mechanical deformation than conventional classical solids like metals and so on.
So for a van der Waals solid, can you give us the number again? Because here you're using a very different spacing than you would in a van der Waals solid.
So if you would have the interesting or the important point is the number of neighbors, which is relatively small, and especially the distance, which is smaller. If you could go to a van der Waals solid, which has the same distance here, so here the argument was 1 to 2 angstrom lattice constant. If you can go down there, then you of course increase the elastic constant significantly. And of course, then you're not that soft going forward anymore. So this is one aspect, and the other aspect, this goes in hand, that you typically, as already illustrated here, that you typically have very large molecules, and that means what you have is you have huge molecules, and of 10 units, however you define these units, whether these units are amino acids or super monomers in the case of a polymer or so. And that leads to an intramolecular entropy, which is given by KT times order of n. So you have such a chain-like object, and that has many ways to organize itself. But at the same time, you have an intramolecular energy, or energy per molecule. It's not intra from the local interaction, so it's intra in terms of interaction between the chain. It is also of the order of KT times order of n. And then the typical translational entropy contribution is typically times KT times order of 1 if I look at this per molecule. And that means that these internal fluctuations play a prominent role on the one hand, and on the other hand, that very small changes in energy, let's say for local interaction energies, add up to a large number eventually, which make, for instance, polymer different polymer systems almost invisible. So it's very difficult to mix polymer A and B, which is technically a huge problem. And from a scientific point of view, I will explain a little more detail later on. This directly comes from this fact, from this combination. On the other hand, of course, soft matter is very versatile. And you might ask yourself, why, for instance, does cohomology deal with soft matter? And there's a very nice argument, which I got from Marcus Cezanne, but I don't know where you got it from, because it goes back to another which is a key principle. So you can ask yourself, if you have a biological membrane, why does it make sense to have this object made up of soft matter and not of something else? Well, you can look at the bending modulus of the system, and it's very important for us that the tissue is soft, that we can bend it around, and it can move around. And then we find that the bending modulus, kappa, is given by, roughly given by 1 over 12, that you can look at with the digits, times the Young modulus, times the thickness cubed. And this thickness cubed is, of course, the important number. And the typical bending modulus of such a membrane is of the order of the order of 20 kT. That means the object is kind of stable with respect to thermal fluctuations, but still deformable. And the energy scale is typically of that of many other molecular processes in biological systems like ATP hydrolysis and so on. But in order to achieve that, you can plug in the numbers here, and then you find for H equals 5 nanometers, and that is typically what you have for a membrane, that you get a Young's modulus of about 8 megapascal, and that's right in the middle of what we have here, or at the beginning of what we have here. So that is a very good number. If you want to achieve the same results with different materials, let's say sheets of materials, like a metal or so, then you have to take into account that your Young's modulus is about 100 gigapascal, so which I mentioned here, and let's say quote-unquote metal. And that would mean that H for this modulus has to be about 2 angstroms only. And that would be a layer of a single atom, and this certainly is not going to work. You might argue maybe graphene can do it, but graphene, of course, is in 2D order, so it's not in the 2D fluid anymore, which is very important for the function of the membrane as well. So the membrane is a kind of barrier material in the cell. It's optimally constructed out of soft matter in this way that you keep in-plane fluidity so that you can have interactions through the membrane, but still it's able to form a compartment which then nicely allows to separate certain areas of the body from each other. So that means What is characteristic for soft matter are the fluctuations in the system, the possibility to have fluctuations coming along with fairly high stability. And what I mentioned already is that it essentially is extremely difficult to mix different macromolecular systems, and I don't want to go to the details of the instrument to prove this easily. But when you see here that, let's say, you have a red polymer in the presence of a white ones, then the interaction energy red to white is proportional to the chain length, and also the interaction energy red to red, if I have, let's say, a 50-50 mixture, it's proportional to chain length. And very small changes where I can drive this phase separation. So that in principle, what you find out is that the critical interaction which drives the phase separation between polymers is proportional to the inverse chain length. This was shown by simulations, but also experimentally, there are fantastic experiments by Frank Bates years ago, where he showed that protonated and deuterated, partially deuterated polystyrene. So you have the same kind of plastic, the polymer, and in one case you have some of the hydrogen atoms replaced by deuterium, and the others you have just hydrogen. If the chains are long enough, they phase separate. This is sufficient. So these minute differences are sufficient to drive that phase separation. And that also, so that goes in along these lines here, and that of course also tells us how critical parameters and reactions in are, or maybe in most cases we try to scare them out, at least on certain levels, to survive.
Of course, studies.
This is one aspect. The other aspect is that this, of course, these kind of properties, which I mentioned before, make the system also very slow. In the field of dynamics, what do I have? I have, on the one hand, I have huge molecules, as I mentioned before. Due to the interaction and the typical distances, I have small gradients in my energies, which are typically of the order of a few kT per nanometer, or maybe 5 kT per nanometer, something like this. And that, together with constraints, for instance, if I look at this situation, this is something completely different from that. And under normal circumstances, a matter of optics, the two chains can cross through each other, for instance, if you have a macromolecular system. And that makes the systems extremely slow. So typically, when you look at, when you take this together and you look, for instance, at the viscosity of a polymeric melt, and the chains are long enough, and this was actually a subject of a program at the ITP in the 80s, one of the very first ones organized by Sam Edwards and Phil Pinkus. The question where this viscosity behavior comes from. At that time, the relevance of this fact was highly disputed, and there were hefty discussions over there in the whole place. Well, actually, my very first trip to the US many years ago. Okay. That gives you a viscosity eta, which is given by A times the number of beads in the chain to the 3.4. And that makes it very, very slow. The whole chemistry, so to speak, is hidden in this prefactor. And I can easily vary this prefactor by orders of magnitude by, for instance, changing a little bit in the chemistry or changing a little bit the temperature. It's easily possible. So for polycarbonate, for instance, we go from a process temperature of 500 to 480 Kelvin, and your viscosity increases by a factor of 10, even though the glass transition temperature is 400 Kelvin. But you also can double the chain length, and then 3.4 is also 10. You also increase the viscosity by a factor of 10. So you have two screws to manipulate the system, and this is exactly what we would like to play with and understand better. And one of the consequences, for instance, if you think of something very simple like tire rubber, we all have that in our cars. Before they do the vulcanization, they have these marker molecules in mats of this picture, so to speak, rolled up, standing there somewhere in the corner. That's a liquid. You should keep in mind that this is a liquid, and on a length scale of about 40 angstroms, 50 angstroms, with fluctuates around, as just as small polymers. And it's very mobile, but these liquids have a rotation time which is so long that you can keep these mats for a few years somewhere in the corner, take them off, roll them off, and then process them. And that's just because of this combination of parameters which make that possible. So it looks like a solid, a soft solid, but in reality it's liquid
with a very, very long relaxation time.
But this is not a glass.
No, it's a liquid.
What's the distinction? It's a very slow liquid.
It's a very slow liquid, and if you look at the, okay, that can become tricky.
Okay.
No, the point is the following: when you look at relaxation in these systems, you can measure. You can measure something like a g of t after, in the simplest case, a step strain deformation. Then you get a very fast relaxation in the beginning, and this is. This is what you get also for short chain systems, and for short chain systems, then it goes like this. And then you plot this on the top plot, clock time, and the chains become longer, it looks like this. And then the chains become even longer, it looks like this. You get a plateau of very slow decay. So this behavior is dominated by this prefactor. And that you can also shift around. By the length, now this here, this time is 10 to the 3.4, is dominated by this effect. Because the chains can only relax the conformation one, but pull out here and go here to avoid what is called entanglement. So not the quantum entanglement, the classical entanglement.
And in this respect, as long as you look on these relatively short time scales, you see that it's all these different systems with many different chains,
they behave the same.
I look like a typical liquid on this plot. Of course, in principle, you can, if you make this infinitely low, so to speak, you can exceed the glass viscosity, the typical glass viscosity. However, you always have this initial soft part compared to typical silicon glass, or so they don't have.
So the distinction to the glass is a short time?
The distinction to conventional glasses is short time. But I don't want to go into the details. What is the difference between, let's say, a silica glass and then such a polymeric system?
Because we can understand 3.4.
Well, the 3 is understood by theory, and the 3.4, I think, is understood now as a finite size effect. At least, if one sticks to the point that the chains, even when they're extremely long, stay Gaussian chains, which are totally intertwined. There are some ideas around that if the chains become too long, that might not exactly be the same anymore. But this is a critical issue because I don't think that there are any simulations or experiments which properly equilibrate these systems to really make a statement about that.
Is there an analog to Stokes Einstein?
Yeah, when you look at large times, yes.
The diffusion coefficient matches. We get some Stokes Einstein.
This also produces a diffusion coefficient, which is proportional to 1 over n squared instead of 1 over n. Coming from this.
What is the range of n in these systems? I mean, it can be as small as 100 or?
Depends. And you think of many biological systems, it's typically, it might be between, let's say, 50 and 100. If you think of technical interesting applications, like polycarbonate for CDs or glasses, it's also about 200, something like this. If you think of structural materials, which are supposed to be really sturdy, it can go up to 100,000 or a million. Okay.
Yes.
Want to say something about it?
10 to the 8 for DNA,
more chromosomes. 10 to the 8 for DNA. Then you can directly bring your example that one has about only 10 to 14 cells and 1 liter DNA per cell in the human body.
gives the length of the NA, what was it, the diameter of the path of Pluto, which we have in our body.
But that's a side remark.
Okay. So that means it's fairly clear that in order to be able to understand these systems quantitatively in a better formation, especially if we think of structure formation or development of function that is important in biological systems, so how do proteins organize both themselves but also organize together with others, or when I think of organic electronics, it's very important to be able to couple the conjugated units of the different marker molecules in a way that you can have charge transport between them, while the side chains you need to make them soluble, to make them processable, typically jeopardize resulting from that. So it's very important to understand the behavior of these systems. And it's also clear, just from these simple arguments, that there's no way to do this with brute force with polyatom simulations. It might not be useful at all as well, but that's a different point. And especially those of us who come from statistical physics originally make this point that in principle it's better to have a hierarchical structure of models to understand the structures of what is going on rather than just drawing with all atoms to the very end. So what that means, in order to be able to do that in principle, the ideal case would be that I start out with some quantum mechanical calculations then have a region where I have all atom structure, let's put it like this, so that this just this little physical area, and then I would like to be able to coarse grain this to a certain extent on a level that my chain looks like this. And this eventually will link that to the continuum model. That this part of the chain is also only a small entity of a shadow which has this picture small molecule has in the system. And here this area one can call also kind of characterized as energy dominated. In a way that here the local interaction energies play a major role of how things interact with each other, while here the conformational entropy dominates the behavior, how you can organize the marker molecule in many ways, so I can call this entropy dominated. And only if these two things come together, we really are able to understand these systems in a quantitative manner, not just in a qualitative manner. And one of the aims of this program is to collect the different ways of doing that we have right now, and maybe get some more generic or universal approach.
So this strategy, which is universal, usually depends totally on locality, whereas you've argued before that there are these non-local effects, like knots.
These knotted effects would come, for instance, into play here on this level, typically. So if you have a model which is very simple, which just keeps the connectivity, and it doesn't preserve this, then you get the wrong dynamics. It might help you to approach equilibrium much faster, but you get to fan on a with a time, typical time
sort
development.
Sort of the next step. So at the middle step, you have these constraints, which are non-local. So how can you
the go from here?
Yeah.
For dynamics, there is at the moment no clean way. That one can clearly say, or should say. So when people do that, they use the setup and then arrive at a description of this level. And either they say, I stick to a model where I forget about these constraints, so I have specific dynamics, which is called Rauch dynamics for polymers, that's important here. Or they kind of interpret the dynamics in terms of these laws which derive from there. But that is very indirect, and especially when you look at systems under shear or so, it's not clear whether this works. This is absolutely not settled. You're absolutely right. Now, when I follow this kind of approach, I can do two things. I can do this either in a hierarchical way, so if I try to do this in scale bridging descriptions, descriptions of simulations,
for what we do here. Similar information. I have two ways of doing that. Either I do it in a hierarchical manner, meaning that I study my system on this level, and on this level, and maybe on this level, separately, and try to link them to each other, or I have a simultaneous option. Namely that I, let's say, have a system like this here, and find maybe here is something interesting going on. Maybe I would like to be here, treating the system on all detail, but here, further out, only on a kind of coarse grain level. And I will give two examples for this and for this, and try to explain a little bit where the difficulties are and where the problems are, which we try to deal with. So that's first. So let's first talk about the hierarchical approach. And this is something which to many of you certainly does look familiar, at least with the perspective of certain link. So let's assume that we have a typical polymer that will draw one chemical structure now because we need it later on as well. Let's think that, say, of typical polycarbonate, which looks like this. So this is one because I think I like this one not only because we work on that, but also this is the only commodity polymer that is used in high-tech applications as well. Not only for the water bottles you have everywhere here, the water dispensers are all made of these materials, but also, for instance, lenses and cameras, CDs and so on are made from polycarbonates. So what I now I want to do is, well, I want to map this, let's say, on a system like this. Take a sphere here, 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 maybe some little line in between, depending on this bond like this, and see whether such a coarse-grained model can describe the properties of that material as well. So that means what I could do is I could write this like this. I have my all atom bases. And there I have my coordinates are high, and I have my coarse-grained system with coordinates r. And then in the simplest case, what I can write is then that r is given by a transformation matrix times r. Yeah, this is not necessarily the fact that it has to be linear, but in general, I can write f of r here, but this is the simplest thing. And this is something which, of course, to many of you looks very familiar, because that reminds me of polymerization group theory, which was done for many, many years. And this can be done here for these kind of systems as well. And you can use two ways of doing that. On the one hand, you can use this analogy to the typical block spin, let's say, polymerization group theory as introduced by Kalanov in 72. And you could try to set on something like this majority rule, and this already tells you what one thing which is going on. So if you, for instance, have a typical Kalanov block spins, let's say you have an Hamiltonian H without the field of iteration K minus KT sum over IJ nearest neighbors SISJ, J index K. And then you have, let's say, a situation like this. K and make a simple majority rule. Usually one should do this from an even, from odd number of spins, but to make it fair, so I just have here an even number. Typically, you have to take three, of course. So that gives you, if you take a simple majority rule, the resulting spin for this one, that is spin up, resulting spin for this one, that is spin down, and that leads then to the Hamiltonian of k plus first iteration, which is then again minus kt, and sum I comma j, here's neighbors again, si, sj, j, k, plus 1. And this, so that means the problem is to determine j properly, k plus 1. And what you see already here is, because this can never exactly match this one, this transformation is highly state point dependent. And you have to keep this in mind. The same, of course, happens when you do something here as well. So you run into the same problems like this. And you can also, and you can now use the analogy, for instance, in the philosophy of the n to zero model of the Gen, where he showed that if you look at correlation functions in such a spin system, if the formally the number of components of the spins goes to zero, only self-avoiding walks, so only polymer-like structures on the lattice remain. This is one way of doing that. We can also use another way, which also actually was proposed by the generator. We can say, well, I don't take this detour via the generating function of the correlation paths. I can make a direct renormalization along the backbone of the chains. So, and that one can do both on a lattice, but also in continuum. And if I do something like this, for instance, so I have a hard sphere system with fixed bond lengths and want to map this on the system with a smaller number of bonds. I have a parameter which describes this, namely the diameter of these spheres and the length of the bonds in between the spheres. And when I then make this kind of normalization group transformation from this one to this one and further on and further on, and write down a flux diagram, which gives delta I minus delta I plus 1. So delta is H over L. Okay. H over L versus delta I. And then for 0, I have the Gaussian fixed point, the chain is a ring walk. I have the diameter of my sphere is 0. And then if I do this in 4 and 5 dimensions, I get a flux like this. If I do it in 4 dimensions, I get a flux like this. The slope 0 here, which fits to the logarithmic corrections on S here. And if I do it in 2 and 3 dimensions, I get a flux diagram like this. Where the Gaussian fixed point now is instable, and it runs to a stable fixed point at characteristic values of its ratio delta H over L. And if I take these values, for instance, in a direct simulation, these are kind of optimal values for the ratio of bond length to exclude volume diameter, the corrections to scaling, the prefactor of the corrections to scaling is the smallest. So, these things you can do, and they work. They are not new, they are old. But there's a significant difference to what you want to do here. Number one, this works only if I do this over and over and over again, which means eventually I'm looking at the asymptotic case where my chain length goes to infinity. That's one point, and of course, when I look at a real material, let's say, or a biological system, I have to keep in mind that my system is finite. And finite size effects play a very important role there also for the function of the system. That is point one. Point two is what we would like to do for many scientific applications and interesting questions, we also want to go back again. So we want to use this
description on a more coarse level, let's say to equilibrate the system, then go back, introduce all the details as far as possible, and use this to go on to study certain properties of the system. So that this generates us characteristic structures for the kind of system. And so there are some similarities, and the ideas certainly are similar. However, one has to keep in mind that one only typically does here one or two steps, maybe three, and then wants to go forward and backward again. And then is the question, what is the kind of property I would like to head for? Because on the one hand, I do this state point dependent. That means, and I have an approximation building, that means that my resulting interactions, which I get, for instance, here, from such a simulation, so I will get a bond angle alpha, a bond angle length L, and a torsion angle theta. Then I reproduce that, but what kind of physical quantity afterwards can I measure? And there's and in the case of this kind of studies where one starts out with such a structure, parameterizes these bonded interactions, and then for the exude volume, only take a simple exude volume for the spheres, reproducing the density of these systems, one can nicely reproduce structural aspects and scattering functions, and can match that with experiment, and can actually interpret experiments properly. And it also works very well for the behavior of viscosity as a function of temperature. So there's a certain transferability of temperature built in this kind of approaches. However, what one has to take into account is that these kind of systems, like polystyrene, polycarbonate, and so on, and they, when you vary the temperature, there are no structural changes. Essentially, they just become slower. There's not much of a change. They become a little bit stiffer, so the chains extend a little more, but they do not really change their structural properties. And because of that, it is possible that this is that we have a certain transferability with respect to temperature in these cases.
So that the thermal expansion is very small as well?
Thermal expansion is reasonably reproduced there, so it's very small as well for these kind of systems. So like this, as I said, applies in this simple way to homopolymer systems. So even though technically very important from research, well, when you talk to people from industry, in many cases they sell a product for years in hundreds of thousands of tons and do not know what they have. And now I sometimes come and realize, oh, the specifications have to improve. Can you help us and tell us what is going on? But this is not really the center of our research anymore, especially of the people who are coming here. So what we are more interested in are biopolymers or more molecules for organic electronics. And for instance, if you think of a typical biopolymer problem, you have, let's say, a structure. You have a denatured or disordered structure of a protein. Then you have a nicely folded structure. I apologize for all who are here working on these models to draw a folded protein like this. And then you have some misfolded system like this, which is known to play an important role in many biological vaccines as well. And if you look at this, and if you do this properly on all atom bases, we get something like a free energy scale, which looks like this. Hopefully this one has the lowest minimum, like this. And of course there's no way within a simulation to follow such a free energy landscape in a proper way. And the question is it possible or can we devise methods which create coarse grain models where we follow this free energy profile close enough to capture these different properties with these different structures on the one hand, and on the other hand, being able to calculate the differences in the free energy by some methods where we maybe functionally reintroduce the details and look at the energy difference. There are some ideas around which already we discussed here last week. So that one gets a feeling for how these systems behave. And this is one of the central questions we are dealing with here, we would like to discuss. I mentioned already the problem of transferability. Another problem is connected to the term representability.
So what does that mean?
That when I mix at the cross-grain step, I try to match certain properties in order to parameterize my cross-grain interactions, because there's no way to explore phase space completely. And one way to do this, for instance, is to match, if I think of liquid, to match radial distribution functions. So if you think of liquid, let's say a simple model like such a tetrahedral molecule, which is a good model for methane, I want to map this onto a sphere-like object to speed up my simulations, then one reasonable way to parameterize my potential is that I say in the liquid, which I'm looking at, that G of R, center of mass atom, equals G of R cosine. If I have done this, that's certainly one step and one way to do this.
However, you pay for that.
If you do that, you pay for it. What does that mean? Well, that means that the compressibility, and that is often an important property in this context, which is given as 1 over rho kt, that's 1 plus 4 pi rho integral t of infinity r squared g of r minus 1 dr. That this, for this model, and this model is the same. Fine. But if I look at the pressure,
it is given as you have the contribution from the kinetic energy,
integral
0 to infinity u prime, g of r, r cubed, dr.
Yes, the derivative of the potentials, of these two potentials, that means that the pressure for this model and for this model will be very different, or will be different. Typically, there's a factor of 4 to 5, but if you think, for instance, of water, SPCE water, when we did this, for instance, you go from P equal 1 bar to P equal 6,000 bar. So you are somewhere different, which comes from the effect that you smooth the potential, you take out the long-range electrostatic interaction, and so on and so on. But you have a dramatically different pressure, and this is something you have to deal with. If you just look at one box of identical particles, that might be not such a problem because you fix the volume. But if you have some interactions with solutes or so, then you might be in trouble.
Wait, so you're saying this here has bigger pressure?
Yes.
So the precise number is 6,200. That doesn't matter.
So, and this is one of the reasons why one might think of a different way of looking at these systems, namely what we can call a simultaneous scalar bridging approach. And the idea is that we have a large system, let's say, and somewhere here in the center, we have a high resolution, we call this the AA or atom, let's say, to make it simple. And here I have a cross-grain regime. And this is also not new, this idea. If you think of studies on crack propagation, for instance, people look at that, so you have a solid. And when you see how this crack propagates, then you might treat it here even electronically, and further out you don't care anymore about the details of the electronic structure. Or you think of the classical QMMM approach, where you also have this kind of geometry. So you have here a classical molecular dynamics approach, here typically something like a CPMD, so Kappa and Enno, or ab initio molecular dynamics. But there you have a problem that you have to fix this or this quantum mechanical regime once and forever. You have to introduce proper boundary conditions for the electronic wave functions. And this part of the chain is always treated
Classically, in this part of a chain, let's say if you think of a macromolecule or of a protein, is always treated quantum mechanically. But what we need, because we deal essentially with liquids, in all cases we deal with liquids, in almost all cases, we need a situation where the particles of molecules can go in and out. So that means, taking this picture again, here the object is a sphere, and here it's a tetrahedron. And when it goes out, it becomes a sphere, and when it goes back in, it becomes a tetrahedron again. And this is one of the systems we would like to look at. We developed one way of doing that, together with Luigi De La Cita and Matej Kropotnik. Matej is coming later this week. Luigi is coming towards the end of the program. And we try to look at such a system and understand how can I set up such a simulation in a way that I now increase this a little bit. I have here an atom region, for instance, when you think of something like water, a coarse grained region, and here a transition region where my object has a kind of dual nature and gradually changes that nature from coarse grained to atomistic or vice versa. Okay, now I have to change one thing because we've always all properties to write it the other way around, otherwise I get confused with my equations later on. But that doesn't matter. So, and the important what you want to have is, you want to have a situation that you have full equilibrium between these two regimes, and you want to have a situation that the exchange here is not at all hindered by this transition region, and that the fluctuations of molecules, the number of molecules or particles in this regime, look like as if I would run this whole system on all atom bases. So this little cavity should not see the constraints, the boundary condition we impose by coupling that to a coarse-grained regime. And of course, this bears a number of questions. One is, how can I couple these different regimes in a proper way? If I'm able to do that, how can I take care that I keep the fluctuations properly, which means the compressibility, being aware that if I do this for water, I have to deal with this problem. And also, how can I define something like a temperature in a way? Because what I do is, when I go from here to there, I change my dimension of phase space by having more degrees of freedom here than here. And that means also, when I come back here, I have introduced kinetic energy with some analogy to latent heat, which I have to give to the molecules when they resume their atomistic detail. And then they go in this direction, I have to take that out. And these are the typical problems one has to deal with if one wants to do something like this. And of course, when this all works, we can, for instance, look at, and that's one of the things we looked at already, at a small biomolecule, let's say, in here, which fluctuates as a function of different solvents moving in and see how it reacts and so on. And we can do this then by very small simulations. So how can one couple this? Well, the first attempt, of course, would be to say, well, I have two interaction energies, and let me just go from one Hamiltonian to the other. So first, I have a smooth transition function here, which we call W of x. If this is my x coordinate. And then the first ansatz would be that my interaction between particle alpha and beta would be W of x alpha times W of x beta times U alpha beta pattern of x alpha minus x beta to make it simple plus 1 minus W of x alpha beta times U cos grade alpha beta. Kind of immediate first guess to do. However,
when you do that, you immediately see that you run into trouble. So if you use this to calculate the forces, let's see if you calculate, I won't go into detail how one distributes the cross wave forces in the transition regime onto the different atoms in the system. That is a technical thing. That's nothing to do with physical questions and so on.
How familiar for different particles?
Sorry? But a different molecule. Let's say if you use this.
Why don't you have a 1 minus omega times omega term?
This is the position of particle alpha, and this is the position of particle beta.
Why don't you have an atom close to an
atom? Then I do not have a smooth transition, and then I run into severe trouble with my boundary conditions. So what you suggest is that I take, let's say, in the case of water, it's all atom up to here, and here it's a sphere, and then I can reintroduce it. For this tetrahedral.
There it's sort of a sphere with probability W.
No, here it's a dual nature. It's both. Here in this transition region it's both.
About weight.
Yeah.
So why isn't there an interaction between water atom,
mm-hmm.
which is there with weight W,
yeah.
for particle alpha,
yeah.
and coarse grain beta, which is there with weight 1 minus W?
This is essentially the way it is done here. So you interpolate these two different models, and then when you are, for instance, in the interpolation region, what you do is you keep your all atom structure and distribute the coarse grain interaction, let's say, from molecule beta onto molecule alpha by distributing that onto all atom degrees of freedom. It's a principle one does, technically one does what you are asking in the transition region.
Yeah.
Okay, we can talk about details later. That's what one problem does. But I wanted to ask for another point. If you do it like this and you write down the force on the particle alpha, it is minus the u alpha the x alpha. And you then see this, you see the standard derivatives of these potentials, I'm going to look down here, plus minus because it's minus w of x beta times u of a v x alpha w alpha plus W of x beta u cosprint times x alpha w x alpha. So you have a classical conservative term plus this term. And this term introduces drift coming from the slope of that W function. This, in principle, one could take care of. However, when you write this down for particle alpha, and you write the same down for particle beta, Newton's third law would say that F alpha equals minus F beta, and you can actually show, you simply write this down, that this only holds if W is constant equal to 1. That means if you use the representation there within a Hamiltonian language, so introducing a Hamiltonian, which interpolates between these different regimes, you violate Newton's third law, and that is something you should not do in a simulation. And the way out is, at least on the first sight, rather pragmatic. What one interpolates are not energies, but just forces. Because the forces between the particles are well defined at every position. And of course, that creates new problems, because we do not have a Hamiltonian. The question is, what is the temperature there, what is the chemical potential there, and so on and so on. So what one interpolates is our forces and not the forces and not the interaction energies.
But that statement, I guess it's the same as saying that this formulation creates a gradient of coupling potential that's driving these fluxes, these false fluxes.
You can set up situations where you don't have a gradient in chemical potential, nevertheless, in flux. There are many, many problems which come up there. It's not... the point is... If you take, let's say, the pressure in such a situation, and fix the density, then you see typical pressure fluctuations in the system. And these you can correct for in a proper way, but that doesn't give you back the Hamiltonian, because you still have this problem of a violation of Newton's free law. The general drift, this I said in the beginning already, that might be something one could take care of. But the problem is Newton's free law at that point. Okay, so what we do is we interpolate forces, so F alpha beta then is exactly the way it's written here, W of X alpha, W of X beta times F atomistic alpha beta plus 1 minus W X alpha, W of X beta F cos gradient alpha beta. And I don't want to go into more details. The only thing I think we have to come to an end, I shortly mention it at the end is, what I do is, when I change this, I change the dimensionality of my find that, of my phase space. So the motion of the molecules go from the coarse grain to the fine grain, or vice versa, the dimensionality of phase space is but in order to introduce the kinetic energy in a proper way, I have to be able to define a temperature, because then I'm allowed to define a thermostat which puts in my energy. And the question is, how can I define the temperature in a situation where I have a continuous variation of phase space dimension? And what I can do is, one can actually show that this W can be interpreted as the fractional dimension of the degrees of freedom which we introduce or take out, and then you can derive a generalized fluctuation dissipation theorem, which tells you, and I think I have to do this in our program once in detail on the blackboard, I haven't yet, which shows that the degrees of freedom, for instance, the temperature is given by KT. Maybe temperature is given by 2 over 2 over the number of degrees of freedom equals F. Ligen the standard way, and then you have, for instance, the translational and rotational degrees of freedom. And in the transition region, you can see that this is, as you have then, that is, let's say, TA in the atom region, and that is supposed to be equal to TB, which is then 2 over number of degrees of freedom prime in the coarse grain regime times the kinetic energy here. And in between, you then have a number of degrees of freedom which is a non-integer. So you can generalize the fluctuation dissipation theorem to show that you have everywhere in this simulation you have a well-defined temperature. And I'm happy to go through this calculation in detail, but otherwise I think probably too late for today. Thank you very much.
So have simulations like this been done already? They work? Certainly they work.
Yeah, they work, yes. The work they have been done for this simple tetrahedral molecule, for water, and also for mixtures of acid molecules.
Water, you're explaining it with me. I'm just doing it.
The water you have is problem, in addition to this, you have this problem of enormous pressure.
Which is not cured by this.
It is not cured by this, but what you do is, so when you run this system in this kind of geometry and fix the density, which you can do as a constraint to start out with, so it gives you then the pressure, which looks like this. It looks like this. And what you keep is, by this ansatz, using the radial distribution function, you keep the compressibility. And when you do this, you can introduce what we call a thermodynamic force, which compensates for that. And by that, you can achieve a situation where you have a totally flat density profile in the system, and you see that the pressure profile increases, and the integral of this thermodynamic force is exactly the chemical potential difference between here and there. You can measure this and compare this in detail. This is a Fischer letter where I'm supposed to submit my page proofs by today or tomorrow.
Any other questions? Okay, well, this was a lovely talk. Thank you.